Howdy, folks. Welcome back to The Naked Pravda. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock. No cold open for this episode because it's long enough as it is. I welcome back to the show anthropologist Jeremy Morris to talk about his new book, Everyday Politics in Russia, From Resentment to Resistance, which features some incredibly rare fieldwork in the era of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. In the book, Jeremy looks at communities in Moscow, regional cities, rural areas, drawing on his decades-long interactions with people. He addresses issues like Russian society's responses to the war in Ukraine, how suffering caused by the USSR's collapse and capitalist social Darwinism has shaped people's mentalities, and a lot more. Check the show notes for a hyperlink to buy the book, and stay tuned for the interview. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. All right, so I have some questions specifically about the book, obviously, but the first one, I thought to get the ball rolling, what I would like to ask is if you could just describe some of the things that you do in your work. You may very well describe it in detail, and I missed it, and I'm sure you've addressed it in other work, but you allude at various points to, you know, the way that you establish these relationships with mm-hmm. your interlocutors is you like work with them, you like do jobs on like lines and so on. You like at one point I think you're like putting together like glass windows or
That's
something
right,
like this.
Yeah.
So like what are some of the things that you do to make a book like this possible that are I know that they're integral to the anthropological work, but they're not what come to mind when you say, oh, hello, I'm a scholar.
Yeah, and I think your question kind of cuts to a lot of the responses kind of incredulity, dismay to disbelief.
No, those are also negative. I'm excited to hear the answer.
Because again, you know, there's, and I don't want to be too self-promotional here, but mm-hmm. you know, there are that many people doing this kind of work, and right. I do kind of pay homage to them in this book and in other work that I write. You know, people like, there are British sociologists, there are Russian sociologists, there are American anthropologists, right? So I'm not the only one doing this, but when I'm presenting this work, very often it's to an audience that, of course, doesn't know what anthropology is, mm-hmm. what kind of ethnographic methods are. So purely due to fate, serendipity, nearly 30 years ago, I started visiting this place that I partially anonymize in Kaluga region, which is about 4 hours drive from Moscow. And over many, many years, I became trusted, embedded, again, you know, immersed. These are some of the more jargony academic mm-hmm. terms that anthropologists use, in part of what is this mixed community of a town, a former industrial town that is in the periphery of Kaluga city itself. And then that town has its own periphery, which is a village where many of the inhabitants of the town have country cottages, vegetable plots that were allotted to them by the main factory. And that's what I write about generally in my previous book. But to give you a kind of idea, so more than 15 years ago, when I became more serious in doing proper ethnographic work, I used my existing connections within the village, which is where I was just visiting every year as a guest, I leveraged that, and through a network of trusted people, I was introduced to more inhabitants and workers in this town. And in fact, it just started with one particular family who feature quite prominently in both of these books, although they're partially obscured for ethical and practical reasons and readability reasons, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was as simple as somebody, what we would call, again, a gatekeeper in anthropology, a person who knew me very well, took me along to the public library, mm-hmm. Which was a real community hub in those days. In small Russian towns. I says, look, this is this person, he knows this person and this person. And, you know, he's part of, you know, he comes to this place all the time and he really wants to know more about this town. And the librarian at that time said, okay, let me have a think. Just sit down here, have a cup of tea. We'll make you a cup of tea in good Russian fashion. And we'll introduce you to, Dedya Nova. Uncle Lev is going to come along for his alternative history collection that he likes to subscribe to and borrow from this public library. And he's a welder. And he can, you know, he's an affable person. He'll take you along. He'll take you under his wing. Yes, you're this strange foreigner. But he'll look after you. His character is more or less suited to putting up with you and introducing you in a safe way that's not going to freak anybody out and not going to put anybody in any, you know, make anybody uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so this is what, again, anthropologists and sociologists call snowballing. Right?
Yeah.
So you go from one person to another person and the snowball of contacts gets bigger and kind of naturally rolls downhill until you get quite a decent sample. I mean, again, we wouldn't call it a sample, but it is. Mm-hmm. And so I often describe, and in the beginning of this book, I kind of try and visualize it as, well, you know, you might have five really close friends, and then an order of magnitude greater than that, you might have 50 people that you frequently interact with. They might be more or less, closer or more distant quasi-friendships, acquaintances, and then you might have a load more, hundreds of people that you interact with professionally, right? Mm-hmm. And so my aim, which was successful over many, many years, decades, in fact, is to go from knowing a few people in the village to knowing a lot of people, more than 50 people that I interact with very, very frequently in this town that I call Izluchino, to many hundreds of people that I've interviewed formally or informally, and again, who I feel have provided a very, very reliable indicator that my research materials, because again, we don't like the word data, my research materials are internally valid is the jargon. But, you know, I think I know what I'm talking about. And I think I know that I can trust what my interlocutors are saying, or I can fact check their ass, right? I can then, and I talk about this in the book, I say,
triangulate.
I can, so when I go and talk to Vadim working at the plastic extrusion factory, making pipes for Gazprom to lay under the ground, when he tells me that he's really, really happy about how the special military operation is going, and he's very careful to call it that and not a war, and that he's not at all bothered that, you know, or worried that he's going to get mobilized, even though he's in his 30s and has already done military service at the age of 18. So he's a prime candidate to be collared, right? And sent off to Ukraine. When he says, oh, I'm not bothered about that. You know, everything's fine. We're going to win and we're going to take Kiev. You know, this kind of facade, this front, I can then not take that as read. And this is the value of ethnography. I can then go and talk to his sister, who I've also known for, I've known his sister since 2009. And she works as a bookkeeper in a construction, again, a construction factory kind of thing. I can sit down to dinner with her a few days later with her husband, who's also works in a metal turning factory, but in a different city in Kaluga region. And casually, I can bring up, well, you know, saw your brother the other day, and he was talking about this and that, and kind of naturally introduce to the conversation these topics in a non-obtrusive, intrusive, natural way, so that I can be more or less confident and use my critical faculties as both a Russian expert, a linguist, which is kind of how I started, but also as a social scientist to combine these roles and combine the roles of somebody who's also part of this friendship circle.
And do you find that you have to, like, catch people off guard, essentially, or is it more about, like, repeating a conversation so that you... Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's the other thing. So again, you know, we very often in research, we only have like an article to present. So we're presenting a snapshot, right, over a few quotes. But yeah, behind those few quotes and the few hundred quotes in this book is, you know, many, many hundreds of hours of interaction potentially with the core group of interlocutors. So yeah, give you an example. Much older interlocutor, we'll call him Nikolai Viktorovich, who used to be the guy that ran the Katilnaya, the heating plant in the town, but he's retired now. How did I gain trust and an insight into his whole worldview, right? By sitting for hundreds of hours in his kitchen with him and his retired wife and his grown-up children and his grandchildren, sitting and him feeding me pelmeni, you know, this, yeah, I don't know how much we would need to translate for our audience.
I think people know what pelmeni are.
Pelmeni, I would guess your listeners know what pelmeni
are. Right, right.
So, you know, hundreds and hundreds of servings of pelmeni have been consumed by me, and not a little vodka, although, you know, I haven't really drunk much vodka for many, many years. Alcoholic beverages have been consumed in Nikolai Viktorovich's kitchen in this small town until I'm almost, you know, I can't bear it anymore, because I have heard the same conversation about how he feels about the supreme leader, about how he feels about the Russian government, which of course are two completely different things in his mind. About how he feels about Ukraine, for example. And that's also quite prominent in this book. How complex people's feelings are about Ukraine. So again, one of the points of the book that, I mean, I hadn't intended to write about Ukraine, because I've been planning this book long before the war, the full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Right.
But of course, that is also something that then emerges, that I have listened to people drone on and on and on, repeating or perhaps interpreting in slightly different ways official propaganda about Ukraine and the West for more than 10 years now, right? Because if you like, people started to really strongly articulate state-led narratives when they became most salient, which is, of course, during and after Maidan, and particularly the annexation of Crimea. Right. So again, you know, I feel like over, especially the last 10 years, I've become very attuned to, if somebody says something that's slightly different, I'm going to pick up on it, because I'm subjected to this endlessly and endlessly. And I, in a different piece, not this book, I also wrote about what it means to be a British person, but it could equally be, you know, an American person, a French person, how they are then reinterpreted their, you know, as a representative of their country. And how you deal with that as a researcher, right? How you have to adopt certain strategies and tactics. But at the same time, we shouldn't, and it's a very, you know, it's an important ethical imperative, we should never be seeking to mislead people about what we feel. You know, I never hide, and I never have to hide the fact that I disagree with the foreign policy of the Russian Federation.
Is that something most people assume anyway?
And exactly, most people assume. I mean, again, that could actually be a very, really... that could be a really fruitful source of getting people to talk about stuff that they wouldn't otherwise feel comfortable talking about. So, for example, again, in a piece that I wrote about homophobia, there's a young guy that doesn't have any of his own children, doesn't have a partner, and he was always saying to me, "Oh, Jeremy, you're so lucky, you've got a family, you've got a wife. Oh, I'll never be able to be like you." And then he would be talking about, he would go off on how it's all the West's fault because they're promoting homosexuality. So he would like go off on this tangent, but provoked by his interpretation of me as a particular type of Westerner. And then we'd also talk about the country that I work in, which happens to be in Scandinavia. And of course, what do many people know about Scandinavia? That it's this hotbed of LGBT promotion, right? And that people often say to me, "Oh, so being in Scandinavia, you're not allowed, your children are not allowed to call you father. Yeah, they have right. to call you parent one or parent two. And so that, just laughing about that. And again, quite often I think being, responding to how people repeat Russian propaganda tropes with either incredulity, which is obviously not genuine incredulity because I've heard it so many times before,
mm-hmm.
but the incredulity one could imagine a foreigner hearing this for the first time would experience, but also just laughing about it and how ridiculous it is itself, again, kind of quite conducive to further discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, what I want from the exchange, which is, of course, instrumental,
yeah.
and I want to know where they're getting that from, mm-hmm. why they feel they need to performatively repeat propaganda right. tropes, and how deeply held these seemingly expressions of value positions really are.
What are the interactions like when you share? I don't know exactly what this process is, but I know that you talk about it in the book a bit, that you essentially share your conclusions with some of these people. And I wonder, what is that like? Are you sharing them? Are you showing them like the full-on academic Argo version, or are you summarizing it in some other terms, or like what are those interactions like? Because it sounds very strange to have a foreign scholar yeah. kind of hangs out with you for years, gets to know you, you know, you feed him pilmeni for hours on end,
yeah,
and then one day he's like, here's something I wrote about you.
So again, you know. It's an ideal ethical imperative. And mm-hmm. to be perfectly blunt, many sociologists and anthropologists talk the talk, but do not walk the walk, right? Mm. So one should, as an ethical imperative, be very, very clear that you are actually conducting research. That's
right.
really important. It's not always possible, obviously. Mm-hmm. In those kind of chance interactions.
In between every pinmini bite, by the way, this is going in the book.
Remember, Nikolai Pinich, thanks right. for your pinmini and the next shot of vodka. But by the way, I am writing this down.
Yeah.
And somebody like that who trusts me, you know, who has this kind of fatherly relationship with me,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't care. He loves it. You know, these people are often, right. people are very often lonely, you know, in all kinds of different circumstances.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be old people, particularly. Mm-hmm. They want to be part of this process. They get a lot out of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, yes.
Getting your analysis must be unusual.
I actually think that it can only improve it when I go back to this factory worker who's like at the heart of a lot of what I do,
mm-hmm.
And say to him, look. I published this article. You can have the article, you can have it in Russian, but you know, you're not gonna be interested in reading this academic pretentious language, just mm-hmm. as most of your listeners might dip in and out of the book, right? Mm-hmm. And the book is supposed to be a bit more accessible. But again, mm-hmm. often as you said, say yourself, you know, the kind of terminology that we're using is to make the findings accessible to other anthropologists, not to lay readers,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So certainly this is also what got me started me off doing writing more kind of blog stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
That this is something that I could link to and show to people in the field. But yeah, there's one particular case, which is again our favorite factory worker who's now in Kaluga itself. And way back in the day, I had this, based on talking to him and his friends, I had this whole thing where I was saying, there's this whole group of younger Russian men who have this identity that they developed through this very conditional interaction with the formal labor market. So they'll come into formal labor in factories. They'll then get really annoyed with it, with the low pay, with the precarity, and they'll feel perfectly confident and it actually be constituting part of their masculine identity as young Russians. To then say, no, I'm going to go and work in the informal economy, right? In the, again, you know, a term that most people in most contexts don't actually use, informal economy. You know, in different countries, we call it the black economy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The gray economy.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to him after I published a couple of these articles, so, no, you know, this is about you. It, you know, I need to make you aware of this. And he's like, okay, yeah. And we talked about it more, and he read some bits and bobs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he didn't have the patience or willingness to sit down and read thousands of words, even in Russian uh-huh. translation. You know, sure. I had actually specifically for him, mm. I had this very early article that I wrote, I think like 2011, translated specifically, not because I wanted Russian academics to read it, but because I wanted people like him to read it and see what he made of it. And he was quite funny. He was like, oh, yeah, you're completely wrong.
okay.
Yeah, you're obviously completely wrong.
Right.
And
does that factor into your triangulation?
And so, again, I reflected on this. I wrote about mm-hmm. how he said that I was wrong, and in some respects, maybe I was. But again, the point was that he represented something that I was observing in more than just his case. So he was representative of this phenomenon of people flitting between formal and informal employment. Mm-hmm. And yeah, what was really useful from that interaction at this kind of higher kind of meta level was that then he was able to come back 10 years later and say to me, ah, yes, not only were you wrong, Jeremy, I've now proven the opposite thesis. I've really knuckled down.
Okay.
And I'm really happy in my really badly paid job in Kaluga, my back-breaking, horrible job that you said that I would never put up with. And it's made me the better man. And, you know, this is now constituting part of my identity. You know, I have gone with the flow. I have knuckled down, and now I've made it as a foreman in a metal turning factory.
Uh-huh. So when you get information like that, is it then back to the sister-in-law, whoever you can ask to get like a better insight into what he says when he's not puffing his chest out? Or, I mean, maybe you're not further pursuing that individual, but like, when you get information like that, when somebody challenges you, and obviously, you know, one's ego is at stake, so people say things, but like, how do you respond to like a development like that?
Again, it's good that you mentioned ego, because that's also part of being there for a long time, right?
Right.
So that they get bored with you, so that you're no longer... I mean, again, many, many years ago, there was a researcher who did a whole article about being the mascot researcher in post-socialist countries, and how she would go to... I think she was working in Central Asia. She would go to Kazakhstan or whatever, and she would be showed off by people. Look, I know this American woman, and she's a researcher, and look, that makes me really cool, right?
Right.
But being there for a really, really long time, you become part of the signature.
You cease to be cool.
You cease to be. In fact, sometimes people don't want to talk to me. Sometimes people are incredibly fed up with me.
Right.
And again, it's part of the skill of being an ethnographer that I'm just sitting there in the back, you know, making my notes or making my observations, or again, using that relationship, which has now just become an ordinary relationship of acquaintance, to then find a new perspective, like the friends of the friends of the friends, while still trying to, of course, retain that relationship. And of course, it being a genuine relationship of friendship now for more than 10 years in the case of some of these people.
Okay.
But sorry, that's kind of going off on a tangent from your
original
question.
I had another methodological question. You write that you try to avoid, or you'd rather avoid, psychologizing, and you instead want to focus on social effects. And then at other points, you talk about wanting to reject social psychology, and you instead, you know, you prefer or favor phenomenological work.
Yeah.
And this gets into a lot of, you write a lot about suffering versus trauma. Yeah. And I definitely want to get to nostalgia versus defensive consolidation. But could you say a little bit about the sort of the difference between... Because a lot of what we've been talking about, I think, like, just a man on the street would say, oh, you're psychoanalyzing these people. But that's not the message. That's not what I'm getting from the book. You're not doing that. You're doing something phenomenological. What does that mean?
Well, again, some of the problems with how people think about ethnography is exactly as you said. They think I'm kind of doing this armchair psychologizing based on interactions. And, of course... Inevitably, there is a little bit of that.
Because you're, I mean, you also talk about people's precognitive dispositions. So it's you know, it's not even what they say. You're like, you're intuiting things that they're not even saying about how they feel about things, which again sounds like, oh, you're like trying to, this is you're guessing at their thoughts or something. I mean, so, but again, like you're specifically saying you're not doing that. So what, again, like the phenomenologic, I'm not going to try to pronounce it anymore, but yeah, I'll let you take it.
Yeah, it's probably the least accessible part of the book's kind of intellectual structure, distinguishing between phenomenology, I can't even say it, and social psychology. Basically, it's a criticism, partly, of some of their very dominant approaches to Russia now, which wouldn't call themselves social psychology, but which definitely, I think, misunderstand what they're doing and are trying to then impute a mass psychological state to different groups of Russians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I'm doing is saying, now, there may be some value in doing that. For example, saying that Russians have a case of mass resentment, right? Mm-hmm. And you could say that's a social psychological state. Mm-hmm. And I kind of partly buy into that. But again, I give it this anthropological twist because I say it's based on their action. I say it's not because of... So social psychologists would say Russians are horribly resentful because they have internalized a sense of geopolitical resentment through their contact with regime ideology. And therefore, they buy into the foreign policy aims, which just so happened to be neo-imperialist, of the Russian state. And that kind of is based on a social psychology argument. Whether or not the people that put forward that argument dress it up as social psychology or not, it is, right? Yeah. And then I'm saying, okay, I accept that Russians are angry and resentful, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I say, well, actually, you have to look at their actual experience over the last 30 years of disappointment, betrayal, and exclusion. Most of those experiences of disappointment, betrayal, and exclusion are nothing to do with geopolitics, right?
Okay.
They're to do with the way that their social state, and we have to be very careful about what we mean by that, the Soviet Union was dismantled, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, most people don't really care about the geopolitical side.
Mm-hmm.
They care more about how there was full employment.
This is the immediacy of material existence.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. So by using this experiential, you know, we don't have to say phenomenology, but this experiential approach, right? Your material experience, the way that's communicated to your children, right? So if I'm denied the opportunity to go to university because I don't have enough money, that will be transmitted in some way to my children, right? If my mother went from working in a scientific lab, having a very prestigious job, to then selling newspapers on the Moscow metro and being arrested and harassed by the police, who are also taking bribes and behaving in rather unpolicemanlike ways. Mm-hmm. That trauma, again, I also hesitate to use the trauma, but maybe social
suffering. You say suffering.
Suffering, that experience of suffering is then becomes a kind of almost master narrative that informs everything else. And yes, it does then mean that even Russians who hate Putin and even Russians who do not support the invasion of Ukraine are primed definitely to accept parts of the narrative that say the West is at fault for what has happened. And yes, this has become some kind of crusade against Russian civilization. I'm not saying that. And again, many people will criticize this book and say that it's an apology for Russia's neo-imperialistic values. And it's definitely not intended to be that way. Because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to explain to people how this broader sense of social suffering can translate into alignment with the neo-imperialistic aims of Putin, but mostly does not.
Okay. So if there is geopolitical resentment, what this book is about is about the anthropological resentment.
Again, you know, and I'm
going to say resentment.
Another unnecessary term, but no, necessary because it distinguishes between geopolitical resentment and social suffering, basically. Yeah.
Right. Why then? I know that you address the question at one point in the book. You may have answered it somewhere else that I missed, but why do we get the anthropological resentment in Russia so much stronger than in other parts of the Soviet Union? Because this is a big facet of the Russians are just a bunch of, you know, their genome has imperialism imprinted on it.
Good question. Two ways of answering it. And again, you know, contrary to people who often think that I am basically just going native and, as I said, acting as an apologist, I, in the book, explicitly say that this does, you know, this does have a reality. Russians are a post-imperialist people. Mm-hmm. And like all post-imperialist peoples, they carry the unenviable burden of being vulnerable to geopolitical resentment at the loss of their great power status, right? And this is something mm-hmm. that is very familiar to me as a British person, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some of the most progressive...
I'll sympathize with you in a few years.
I'm not going to talk about the United States at the moment. But let me just say that as a British person, I interact with people who I would say are very, very progressive on all issues, and yet find it almost impossible to acknowledge that the project of the British Empire was, on balance, a very bad one for large parts of the world.
Yeah.
Right? And so we shouldn't be... So in a sense, I'm not apologizing for all Russians, but I am kind of normalizing this experience. I'm saying, well, why wouldn't we expect many Russians, yes, to have something of a post-imperial syndrome, whatever you want to call it. But again, what I'm saying is actually what's positive, and this is a very positive book, what's positive is that many, many Russians do not have that, or they are able to overcome it, or it is really not very important, quite often because they feel a very strong sense of solidarity with Ukrainians, whether or not they can articulate that or verbalize that publicly or not. And again, this is why the book really starts out with a very long, circuitous, and it has to be circuitous, debunking of what I believe is the myth of the large pro-war majority, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I do that by saying, yes, there's a large cohort that are actually very fearful and unhappy about the course taken. Yes, there is a very small, but very vocal minority. Okay, I should say not very small, but there is a minority, right, that is very vocal. And and I agree with those quantitative or survey-based studies that say, yes, there are 15 to 20% of people that do buy into neo-imperialist or whatever we want to call it, aggressive foreign policy aims, right?
And one of the terms you use to describe this is defensive consolidation, and you distinguish it from rally around the flag effects.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about why, because I think the rally around the flag thing is most likely the sort of the consensus view among a lot of Western viewers or pundits and so on. The Russians have rallied around the flag because they even the ones that maybe are critical of Western consolidation around Ukraine, they'll say, oh, well, you've only mobilized the Russian people on behalf of this war because, you know, their sanctions and so on have just caused everyone to rally around the flag and so on. And you're saying, you use this term defensive consolidation. You say it's different. What exactly makes it different?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's a negative form of rally around the flag. I mean, I don't really like...
Rally against the flag.
rally around despite the absence of a flag. to run.
Okay.
So rally around the flag. I mean, if we
circle
think
the wagons.
If we think mm-hmm. of if we think of the way that people in the U.S. responded to 9/11, mm-hmm. it was with outrage, and it was with knowledge that as the global hegemon, the U.S. Had been attacked and could do something about it and could show the world what it was made of. Mm. Boy, did it do that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So I also then object to the way that people use it, because it also is always used, it finds its origin in these democratic contexts that are very, very far away from the Russian reality. Right. Defensive consolidation, by contrast, draws attention to the way that obviously people have, and here we do get into psychologism, right? Mm. People do have this cognitive dissonance, right? Ukrainians are like us, more or less. They may be politically errant. We may believe on some level that they have been wrongly co-opted by Western forces, blah, blah, blah. You know, Maidan, all the conspiracies about Maidan. Mm-hmm. But in no way, shape, or form do the majority of Russians, if you ask them in February 2022, want to start a war with their nearest neighbor, right?
Right.
So how can this be rally around the flag? Yes, certainly there is then a sense, well, okay, this has started, we've got over our shock. What could we do about it that doesn't then perpetuate this cycle of virulent, rabid, nationalist, largely empty propagandizing around the so-called Z people, right? Most yeah. people still, after 3 years of war, feel very little but either pity, incredulity, or even disgust towards the Z propagandists, because not necessarily because they are hugely anti-war, but because they see these people for what they are, which is naked opportunists and people who are actually quite marginal politically, right? Mm-hmm. So defensive consolidation is that the war actually makes a lot of people wake up from the sleep, the long political sleep that they'd had under Putinism, which is that, okay, you know, we're excluded from political discourse. Our ideas don't matter. Our desires don't matter. But, you know, Putin is chugging along, kind of improving things, and it doesn't really matter. You know, he's made a compact with us, which is rising standards of living, better social services, better social infrastructure, a better future for our kids. We keep out of politics. And yeah, there are some externalities, which is high level of corruption. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things are okay. And then the war actually forces people to confront the failure of quote unquote Putinism, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that he was so lacking in, or rather the elite was so lacking in ideas, or the elite drank so much of their own Kool-Aid that they decided that they would crown their achievement by invading their neighbor, right? And cutting off Russia, probably for the next number of generations, from the global, the quote unquote civilized world, right?
The garden of civilization.
The garden of civilization. Mm-hmm. That we should use ironically here, in case of anybody listening thinking that. Mm-hmm.
Air quotes.
Air quotes. So, a lot of people that I find are become very, very focused on what they did not get out of this compact. So they focus much more on things like inequality, on the degradation of the environment, on the complete lack of renewal of social infrastructure over the last 30 years, despite the oil bonanza, right? And again, they might not even consciously allow themselves to criticize the special military operation, mm-hmm. but they might then become much more frequent in their remarking on the fact that corruption means that there is not even an asphalt road between the town and the hospital. Mm-hmm. That the hospital was promised chemotherapy machines or equipment in 2016, and that those machines were never delivered. That the local school has children attending it in the evening because there are not enough classrooms. despite the demographic decline in Russia, right?
Right.
That the school teacher who has a higher degree, and so has a postgraduate degree, is paid less than the caretaker, the janitor of the school, despite all of Putin's promises, right? So defensive consolidation is, yes, this geopolitical catastrophe means that now we are isolated. That isolation should then prompt us to reflect and perhaps come together in some ways to socially renew Russia and try to find another answer, a genuine answer to the question of what unites us as Russians, because it sure ain't a militaristic disaster that we are witnessing.
And so the consolidation then is this, are these like civic groups trying to create the services that the state has abandoned?
And so there's part of that in the book, although, you know, I'm in no
like
way...
Like when they're consolidating to what end, I guess, is the question.
So this, I think this takes place on a personal level. And again, it's not about psychologism, because it's something that they articulate very consciously and looking for. If we look at, for example, it's not part of my research, but if we look at the response to the oil spill in the Kerch, the Kerch oil spill, right?
Right.
That, I think, is partly a response to the building of civic capacity, partly thanks to Navalny, partly thanks to oppositionist big politics. But it's also a response to the kind of social cry for help within the body politic of Russia, which is that we need something to show to ourselves who we could be and what good could come of what has obviously been a catastrophe and will be a catastrophe.
And another question. So we've been talking about what I think at one point you described, or you might be attributing this to a different scholar. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but you talk about frustrated social connectiveness. And this is, again, this gets into the resentment stuff about having the Russians are, you notice that a lot of Russians are sort of seeking for the like self-worth that they either felt in this during the Soviet Union, or that they are led to believe was
possible,
given to people, you know, because a lot of people weren't alive during the Soviet Union, or they only remember.
And a lot of people
stories.
Did not, you know, a lot of people did feel very alienated and unhappy during the Soviet Union.
Sure.
We've also, you know, again, people will say that this book is also an apology for the Soviet civilizational
system,
project,
sure,
right? And again, it's not. And I'm very careful to say, it doesn't matter what the Soviet Union was.
Yeah, this is how people think of it now.
This is how people couldn't use it, right? Including people 30 years younger than me.
Right.
Who have no living experience beyond this millennium, right?
Okay.
So yeah, social connectiveness is related again to defensive consolidation. It's also what feeds some of these responses, these positive responses to the war. But then I say this has a genealogy that goes back to the Soviet project, right? Which, despite itself, despite its failings, despite all the evils that it produced at home and abroad, created a template of thinking about the better future for one as part of a kind of social whole, right? And that one could do something incredibly mundane with one's life, but that actually served a greater purpose, right? So yeah, boiled down, it's certainly the utopian project could not but affect how people reflected about their own lives, even if their lives were really miserable quite often, right? Even if they were characterized by want, disappointments, and oftentimes, you know, experiences of violent state violence, right?
Right.
And that, again, like some of the other things that I talk about in this book, this is part of a intergenerational form of communication, right?
Right.
That we don't need psychologism. We don't need social psychology to understand this, because it's about just the experience of being in a family where a parent has experienced extreme social downward mobility. The example that I gave earlier, right? Almost not a universal experience, but an experience that everybody would have been exposed to.
Right.
Okay, women were not liberated and had sometimes quite shit lives in the Soviet Union. Right. But women were able to access higher education, and many women achieved a high level of social prestige, relatively speaking, thanks to the Soviet project, through science and education and engineering even, right?
And they were hit harder in the 90s.
Yeah, so again, one of my key interlocutors' grandmothers designed power stations in Vietnam, right? I can't imagine a woman in my own country of that age achieving that kind of whatever you want to call it. Yeah, social lift, again, as the Russians talk about nowadays. And that's thanks to the Soviet project.
Mm-hmm.
Her daughter also becomes a scientist, but ends up, as I said, selling newspapers on Kaluga trolley buses, harassed by the police. This experience of disappointment, this experience of betrayal, this experience of resentment, social suffering, is then transmitted and then informs how people then reflect on the template of the Soviet system. Even though, again, this family had members who were shot in the 1930s. That's not relevant. You know, that state violence is not relevant to the template of de-alienation that the Soviet project provided. And this is, again, something that I don't argue. This is an argument from Kety Jukharov's book, which is a philosophical book about the Soviet project. Georgian Russian philosopher Kety Jukharov.
Okay. You have a whole chapter on capitalist realism, and you tell readers that the authoritarian neoliberalism that underpins the Russian state, bearing that in mind, it would behoove a lot of Western readers to view Russia as a vanguard and not necessarily as this funny post-Soviet place where you have the imperialist sort of, you know, undertones of people's thought, but also that, because a lot of like the literature about Russia is, and even what it sounds like a lot of Russians have self-internalized, is like, oh, these bunch of losers can't cut it in the market economy. Yeah. And, you know, now they're so bummed out about themselves that they're becoming militaristic and so on. And it's all rooted in you know, their failures and whatnot. How should, given that that's probably a bias that a lot of Western readers will have, and given also the fact that a lot of this book is about this very, it seems very particular, you know, resentment stuff that we've been talking about, that seems, it's all very rooted in the loss of, you know, Soviet mythology or Soviet purpose, or, and so on. I mean, why should, say, an American or a British person read about, you know, the sort of the effects of collapse of the Soviet Union on Russian mentality or Russian, you know, social interactions and so on, and then say, oh, well, Russia's at the vanguard, aren't they? I mean, it seems like it's difficult to reconcile those two things.
Well, by vanguard, I mean, when I use the term vanguard, I'm drawing together essentially two ways in which Russia, the way that Russians live and have to find their way and survive, prefigures much more extreme forms of exploitation and authoritarianism that we are already experiencing in our Euro-American societies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by vanguard, it's not a conscious thing. So some writers talk about how Russia is an authoritarian entrepreneur, right? State in it actively says, look, we are the leaders of the authoritarian world. We are the leaders of the sovereign democracies that are illiberal or anti-liberal, right? This is a different argument. That argument is really, really quite interesting and certainly has quite a lot of truth in it. There's this reflexivity among the Russian elite that they try and show themselves as this authoritarian model. No, I'm saying that particularly in the world of waged work and the extreme inequality that is visible to all Russians, they are a vanguard in that they show how bad things could get in our own societies, right? So we still have, at least in many European countries, a functioning welfare state where the elderly, the disabled, and the young have access to quite significant forms of protection from the predations of the market, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have trade unions that are much diminished, but still can protect workers. We have labor laws, environmental laws that, again, protect us from other forms of harm, right? Mm-hmm. Social and environmental harm. And in Russia, of course, what we know is that when there are protections, where there is the veneer of a social state, largely it's experienced as a fiction by Russians themselves. So again, in this chapter that you're referring to, I object to some of the, what I would call, quite conservative consensus among so-called Russian liberals that, mm-hmm. if anything, ordinary Russians have done pretty well out of Putinism. I really reject that case. And mm-hmm. I use ethnography to illustrate how even for, you know, Russians who are both, so a Russian family, right? Russian nuclear family, both parents are in employment, both parents have educational credentials and skills. They have children who are in full-time education and who benefit from certain benefits. They unequivocally experience reality as extremely economically precarious and hostile, right? And while I use the term capitalist realism, perhaps a more accessible term that I adopt is social Darwinism. That is that many, many Russians, including vulnerable Russians, have internalized quite an extreme sense that if you're rich, you deserve it, and you're smart. If you're poor, you don't really deserve anything, and it's your own fault, and you might as well die.
Isn't that the opposite of resentment, though, or resentment? I thought resentment is like you, if you feel on the wrong end of something, you decide or you rationalize that it's the people who have what you want are evil, and that you don't have what you want because the system's unfair, or something like that.
In a system where the haves are like, we've got what we've got because we're so smart.
Right. Which Elon Musk's of the world.
You only have to speak to a few Russian entrepreneurs or academics to experience an extreme sense of self-satisfaction, unearned privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the vast majority of Russians who are like struggling to survive and have very few assets and opportunities and capitals, have very few educational credentials, have very little economic capital, maybe little cultural capital. Mm-hmm. To see that Russia is this extreme example of a class society. And that this is also expressed through all kinds of othering and stigmatizing language, right?
Sure.
So we think of one of the big problems today in America is that a certain politician called a lot of people who could have voted for her deplorables, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that this had real effects in the real world. Mm-hmm. Again, I would say Russia is a vanguard in that it shows a much more extreme example of that. And again, this is why I'm doing this research, because mm-hmm. most Russian social scientists would see getting their hands dirty in this way as beyond pale, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can work with statistics about how reactionary and backward-looking and unpleasant ordinary Russians are, but we don't want to go and talk to them because that would be icky.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but the ones who are on the bottom of the market relationship, but they're internalizing the social dharma. It makes sense to hear elites saying that, but
so inevitably we all internalize ourselves in all societies as self-regulating organisms responding to the demands of the job market, right? Unless we happen to be bought into wealth, right?
Yeah.
So again, Russia is not different in that way. It is more extreme, and yes, it is less hopeful or more imbued with hopelessness because a lot of the times people cannot see out of this. At the same time, this does compete with the narrative of social connectiveness that I spoke about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's why, indeed, resentment can go one of two ways. it could be channeled. And this is why Russia is so similar to the United States and many other places, right? It could be channeled into extremely destructive forms of blaming the other, deflection by political elites of the very much homegrown problems that have been stored up over decades. Or, yes, if we're going to be more optimistic, it can lead people to reflect on that an alternative is possible, could be possible. We might think of it as unrealizable without fundamental social change, but we still recognize it as a potential good, right? A potential way of organizing or ordering our society in the future. And that future may never come, but once again, it comes back to this kernel of utopian thinking that never goes away, especially in a place like Russia, where, you know, like it or not, one cannot but reflect on the fact that there was a state that was initially built with this utopian purpose in mind. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So certainly, there is a tension there in that despite these extreme experience of social Darwinism, where, you know, I talk to, you know, most of my quote unquote Russian friends are extremely middle class, highly educated Muscovites, right?
Yeah.
And I often talk to them, and they talk about the people that I interact with in the town and the village as, you know, the word that Russians use, cattle or biomass or all of these stigmatizing words, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, useless eaters or whatever. Or, again, since the war, of course, it's very then easy to label the less privileged Russians as the ones that
are fueling the whole thing.
That are fueling all of this. Yeah.
Right.
When, of course, even survey data indicates that you're more likely to support the war if you're educated.
Mm-hmm.
And you're more likely to support the war if you have skin in the game, if you have some kind of wealth, unearned wealth.
Right.
And that's certainly borne out, you know, because some of my interlocutors are business owners, right?
Right.
And again, thanks to my positionality as an educated Westerner, of course, I can also interact with educated, wealthy business people in Russia who are also very keen to talk to me and very keen to say, we're going to win, we're going to take Kiev again. It doesn't matter what cost. And of course, it's at no cost to them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And they are definitely beneficiaries of the war. Many of my interlocutors are beneficiaries of the war, certainly. But not among your average Joe working in the metal plant.
And this sounds like this is sort of touching on, I know that on your most recent blog post, you criticized the Medusa and I think the Bell. I don't know if the Bell had an interview with William Pyle or they're just referring to the same research, but Medusa had...
It's the same.
The same research. So it's William Pyle, sociologist, is that right? He's a sociologist?
He's an economist.
Economist, oh, even worse. He's an economist commenting on this Russian longitudinal monitoring survey.
Yeah.
And he has these comments about malignant patriotism. And the takeaway, if I'm remembering it correctly, is that essentially... military-industrial complex funding is going out to these rural factories, and that the local factory workers are getting money, and so that they're saying, okay, well, the war, this is making us feel optimistic about life.
Yeah, and I mean, the interview was a really good interview.
I mean, people can go read your blog post, but you're being very kind now. But I guess so. People can go read the blog post for your take on the interview.
I can really, really. No, I want to get to this, which is that.
Okay.
So, William Pyle put together.
He mentions you in the interview, of course.
With the Bank of Finland, they use this data, which is very reputable data, which involves sitting down in Russian people's homes and asking them.
And coming back to them most
importantly. When was the last time you bought something like a fridge or a washing machine? And that's really useful.
Yeah.
And do you feel confident that if you lost your job, you have enough savings to survive the next 6 months? And there are some very significant upticks, right, on that.
Mm-hmm.
And my criticism of the Medusa interview is that it generally focuses on reinforcing this message that there is a big majority that are beneficiaries, and that they are consciously reflecting on how the material position has improved thanks to the war, and therefore they support the war. Now, I don't think even William Pyle was really arguing that.
Right.
He did then riff off in the interview from the survey, which shows some improvements in material expectations, to another article that he'd written, which is also a really interesting article, which is about malignant forms of nationalism. And that one of Russia's problems is that if people are nationalist, they're often nationalist in a nasty way, right?
Yeah.
And again, we can agree with that, right? My point in the blog post is that when we actually look at the report that William Pyle and Back of Finland put together, there's some very mixed messages there, right?
Yeah.
And the perhaps the biggest message, the one that the Medusa interviewer did not dwell on or inquire into, is that it's still only 50% of Russians that have any positive evaluation of their material circumstances.
Right.
So it's hardly a ringing endorsement of the status quo. And that's pretty bad. And again, some other statistics that are pretty woeful. But it's also true that, if you're working in some very limited areas of military-industrial complex, of course your take-home pay has increased a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What I've written about elsewhere is that inflation is notoriously undercounted and distorted by the statistics. And what I find, again, in my own talks with all kinds of people is that most people who rely on a wage, whether that is a kindergarten teacher, whether that is a metal worker, whether that is a professor in a Moscow university, whether that is a person working in the security services, they are not very happy because the cost of living has outstripped significantly any increase or indexation. And indeed, most people have not really experienced even nominal, I shouldn't say nominal indexation because that doesn't make sense. Yeah, they've been told that their pension has been indexed, right? But even the diehard Putin grannies, right, of which there are many in my research, who say, oh, poor Vladimir Vladimirovich, he's trying his best. He's doing a great job. It must be very hard for him there in the Kremlin with the burden of our future on his shoulders. Yeah, okay, so this is a real thing. And again, I'm not denying that. Even then, in the next sentence, they're saying, and I've been told that my pension has been indexed, but it hasn't. because inflation is out of control.
Right.
So that was the thing that I was blogging about. And I mean, I should also say that I like the kind of approach where economists like William Pyle try to triangulate these very raw economic indicators with this much more, I think, reliable form of survey data, where you're actually going and asking people in their homes, concrete questions that, again, are not just a snapshot. Do you agree with the aims of... Do you agree with the Russian army's actions in Ukraine? And, of course, if somebody is phoning me or asking me on the street, I'm going to say, yes, of course I do. This is totally different, the stuff that he's working with. Like I said, it's like, did you buy a fridge or a washing machine in the last 12 months?
Right.
So there's a lot of use in that. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I wanted to ask you a question about this is the last question I have, about what kind of anthropological concepts or methodologies you might recommend journalists try to use more in their work. I feel like now that I'm thinking about this aloud, I feel like I've probably, when I had you on the show last time, however many years ago it was, and we talked specifically about using sociological polling, you kind of said exactly what you just said now, which is that too much of it is snapshot stuff and that people are you know, misreading it, or that the polling itself is just sort of shallow. Is there anything beyond that kind of sensitivity to sociological work or to this sort of like large end polling that is often abused in journalism? Is there something else that you think journalists listening to this interview, for instance, what should they take from your work that you think that would benefit their work?
So it doesn't have to be my work. It's
your field, I mean.
quite a few things, actually. So there is already lots of journalism that does not rely on talking heads, on experts, on pundits,
right,
which is how I think, you and I started our conversations right just before the war started. I was criticizing the punditocracy, right?
Yeah.
As it pertains to Russia, and how very often the experts who are given a lot of space and time in all media are people that have never gone beyond the Moscow Ring Road. That was how I kind of visualized it for people. But what I would say is that there's already really good crossovers between journalism, mainstream journalism, and much more engaged, reaching outreach type, observational reportage. Again, shout out to Siem Na Siem, seven times seven media company, I guess, who have a very, very underpromoted travelogue throughout Russia, that where two Russian journalists who are really, I think, just citizen journalists, go from town to town asking people what are the important things happening in their lives and in their locale, what are the biggest challenges. And that's brilliant. And that's really close, I think, to what sociologists and anthropologists do, right? So
in that regard, it's kind of interesting, forgive me the aside, but like the fact that it's illegal, essentially, or it's too dangerous to ask people directly their opinions about the war and about overt politics, people are sort of forced to use the indirect triangulation that anthropologists are trained to use anyway. Journalists, I mean, or just it's citizen journalists. It's kind of what you have to do now.
Yeah. And of course, we should still be talking about the war.
Well, yeah, but you have to. You're triangulating it, right? You can't ask directly necessarily, or at least not a man on the street.
But again, it's also a big problem that, especially in Anglophone journalism, we focus so much on the war that your average person might get a really distorted perception of in fact, how normalized, unfortunately, the war is in Russian society. So again, people again think that I'm trying to prove some crazy point that the West's sanctions have failed or something by saying that life is pretty normal in Russia. No, on the contrary, if anything, we're saying that, there's a huge problem with the way that the war is presented, in that people don't understand how easy it is for a Russian person to distance themselves from the war. And again, it's not up to me to decide how policymakers want to respond to that, right?
Yeah,
but again,
yeah,
you could certainly use my argument to say that we should be doing more sanctions. We should be we should be doing much more active things that I'm not going to express in any interview. Certainly creating a much more realistic version of how Russian society functions that doesn't come down to Levada says number, number says Russians bloodthirsty orcs. Therefore, we can all feel self-satisfied liberals that we're not like that.
Right.
Sorry to give a kind of parody of something, but certainly, it certainly feels to many of me, to me and my colleagues, it certainly feels the reliance on people who clearly have an ideological agenda. So I will never hide the fact that my research is informed by my personal politics, right? Which are progressive politics. It's impossible to divorce oneself from that. Of course, I try and reflect on that and be objective. What we find incredibly frustrating is that when people trot out the Levada figures, and I mean the venerated sociologists, Russian sociologists, they fail to acknowledge that they have a very, very significant ideological bent, right? An ideological perspective on Russia themselves that is never acknowledged, right? So again, people will say, oh, Jeremy is speaking from a leftist position, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, his work can be dismissed, right? Or he's a pro-Russian, therefore his work can be dismissed. But I would like to argue that my work is far more reflexive about the ideological implications that it has, right, than the work of Levada, right, for example, or people that uncritically use the work of Levada, right? Because the very fact that they're asking some questions and not other questions, or they're asking questions in a particular way and not another particular way, is really indicative of the problems with polling. Now, of course, you know, there are all kinds of different pollsters, and it's much better than that now. But the other thing I was going to say then is, yeah, just diversity of voices. Another problem that we haven't touched on and that we don't have time to touch on and isn't really relevant to the meat of our discussion today is the constellation of Russian voices in exile, which is generally the same people who more or less have the same political positioning again, which is kind of unacknowledged, this universe of experts that I think really limits the perspective that Anglophones have of Russian when they're exposed again and again and again to the same people. Some of them, of course, are brilliant experts, but there should be more diversity. And I don't mean political diversity, really. I just mean diversity of voices who have something to say about Russian politics and society.
And I imagine, on that score, it's probably more cause for pessimism than optimism, given that many of these people will not be going back and refreshing any ideas. And the sort of nature of Russia expertise is, it doesn't seem likely that it's headed for an explosion of diversity. I don't know. Do you feel differently?
Yeah, I do feel differently.
Okay.
It's not, I mean, I understand where you're coming from. And yes, I think that we're now stuck because obviously people do focus on the geopolitical situation, the war. Those voices will continue to be dominant.
Right.
Because, of course, there are people whose job it is to be both Russia experts, but also speak to the geopolitical implications, stuff about the military, stuff about the economy, right? Okay, but at the same time, there are people who are much more talented and insightful social researchers than me who will continue to do ground of research in Russia, on Russia, or on non-ethnic Russians in the Russian Federation, on the wider region, on Ukraine. So again, you know, the book that I most admire that's in the last 3 years since the invasion about Ukraine is a book, again, by an anthropologist who went to live in East Ukraine and talked to people about how they became Ukrainians, right? How they became real Ukrainians, right? Ukrainian speakers, how they deal with all kinds of similar problems of deindustrialization and since the fall of the Soviet Union. But again, those voices
which book
are
is
there.
That, by the way?
That's Denis Gorbatch, The Unmaking of the Ukrainian Working Class. So obviously I have a professional interest in his topic, but his book is also all about Ukrainian politics. It's as much about Ukrainian politics, as much about the phenomenon as Zelensky, as it is about coal miners, right?
Okay.
So the point is that, yes, the kind of big politics sphere, of course, in Anglophone journalism will continue to be dominated by the same Russian voices in exile, and there are some big problems with that. But at the same time, you know, there are articulate, accessible Russian researchers and Ukrainian researchers and Kazakh researchers doing stuff that's really important. And they're publishing in English, and they speak English well, and they are highly articulate and have something really important to say. And so these are the people also that I try in my book to say, well, okay, I have this idea, but you know, I'm just an English researcher doing this thing. There's also, there is also a universe of really, really, really good quality social research, alternative political research on Russia, Ukraine, Central Asia, that's out there. And here, look, I'm citing it in my book. Right. So the final political act of my book is to promote the voices of, we don't really like the term native or indigenous researchers, local researchers, many of whom do remain in Ukraine, Russia, and other places.